The Devil's Advocates radio show is broadcast under a time brokerage agreement between Devil Radio and Civic Media, Inc. Some portions of this program may be pre-recorded. Warning! You're about to listen to the greatest radio show ever, and due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves and corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics, and due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. Now live from the Civic Media Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning, welcome to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
And now, here's your hosts, Dom and Crute.
Welcome to the Devil's Advocates radio show, the Thank God It's Friday edition. How you doing, little buddy?
Awesome, Crudy. Happy Friday to you and to Rich. Thank you, sir, our fair audience. Happy Friday to us all. 844-967-2789.
Dom, we look forward to being joined by a fine guest. He is James Santel, former U.S. attorney. He's the host of Amicus, a law review, Saturday mornings on the Civic Media Network, 9 to 11, but check your local listings. He joins us about 4:30, about 25 minutes from now, Dom. And we've got some pressing legal issues to discuss with Mr. Santel. Also, some of the breaking news. Oh, yeah. By the way, thank you, Matt Rothschild, Batman, for joining us during the Wisconsin Happier Hour, the 3 o'clock hour. If you don't tune in, try us on the stream or find us on WMDX. We start at 3 hours a day. That's all we ask. But Dom, the exclusive at the Washington Post, the breaking news, $10 million cash withdrawal drove secret probe into whether Trump took money from Egypt. You know, like Senator Bob Menendez. It's almost like the Egyptians were trying to influence American foreign policy.
And it looks like, at least in the case of Menendez and perhaps Donald Trump, they found some willing recipients, some willing players.
Dom, this an exclusive at the Washington Post, Aaron Davis, Carol Linig. 5 days before Donald Trump became president in January 2017, a manager at a bank branch in Cairo received an unusual letter from an organization linked to the Egyptian Intelligence Service. It asked the bank to kindly withdraw nearly $10 million from the organization's account, all in cash. $10 million in cash. Kindly. Inside the state-run National Bank of Egypt, employees were soon busy placing bundles of $100 bills into two large bags. I wonder who the bag man was, Tom. According to records from the bank, four men arrived and carried away the bags, which U.S. officials later described in sealed documents as weighing a combined 200 pounds and containing what was then a sizable share of Egypt's reserve of U.S. currency. They cleaned them out, basically, is what this article is implying, Dom. Now, federal investigators learned of the withdrawal, which has not been previously reported, early in 2019. The discovery intensified a secret criminal investigation that had begun 2 years earlier with classified U.S. intelligence, indicating that Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi sought to give Trump $10 million to boost his 2016 presidential campaign. Since receiving the intelligence about Sisi, the Justice Department had been examining whether money moved from Cairo to Trump, potentially violating federal laws that ban U.S. candidates from taking foreign funds. So, if he got $10 million from Egypt, it was illegal. I read on. Investigators had also sought to learn if money from Sisi might have factored into Trump's decision in the final days of his run for the White House to inject his campaign with, wait for it, Dom.
How much?
What a coincidence. $10 million of his own money.
Of his own money. Wow. Trump went to pocket for 10 mil.
I haven't seen him spend any of his own money before or since them, own money, air quotes. Those questions, at least in the view of several investigators on the case, would never be answered, the Post found. Within months of learning of the withdrawal, prosecutors and FBI agents were blocked by the top Justice Department officials from obtaining bank records. You can't follow the bank records? Don't they say follow the money, Dom? Let me read on. They were blocked by top Justice Department officials from obtaining bank records they believed might hold critical evidence, according to interviews with people familiar with the case, as well as documents and contemporaneous notes of the investigation. The case ground to a halt by the fall of 19, as Trump's then Attorney General, William Barr, raised doubts about whether there was sufficient evidence to continue the probe of Trump. Well, if you won't let them look at the bank records, I bet they came up short of evidence to your standard, didn't they, Bill?
It's amazing how that happens. Crudy, the behind-the-scenes drama played out during an especially tense time for the Justice Department, with Trump accusing the agency of pursuing a politically biased witch hunt against him in its probe of Russian election interference, his appointees seeking to rein in investigators they saw as partisan, and some career supervisors growing weary of plunging the agency into yet another legal battle with the president. But hey, if you got the evidence there, and this comes in from what, the CIA? Now, Barr directed Jesse Liu, the Trump-appointed U.S. attorney in D.C., to personally examine the classified intelligence to evaluate if further investigation was warranted. Barr later instructed FBI Director Christopher Wray to impose, quote-unquote, adult supervision on FBI agents Barr described as hell-bent on pursuing Trump's records. According to people familiar with the exchange, it is unclear what, if any, actions Wray, who was also appointed by Trump, took in response. In June of 2020, the prosecutor Barr appointed to take over the office leading the case closed the probe, citing a lack of sufficient evidence to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. That conclusion belied the months of internal disagreements over whether investigators had been allowed to go far enough in seeking that evidence. Every American should be concerned about how this case ended, said one of the people who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss internal dissension. The Justice Department is supposed to follow evidence wherever it leads. It does so all the time to determine if a crime occurred or not. A spokesperson for Trump's presidential campaign did not answer a list of questions from the Post, instead of referring to this story as textbook fake news. The investigation referenced found no wrongdoing and was closed, spokesman Stephen Chung said by email. None of the allegations or insinuations being reported have any basis in fact. The Washington Post is consistently played for suckers by deep state Trump haters and bad faith actors peddling hoaxes and shams. An Egyptian government spokesman declined to answer detailed questions sent by the Post. A quote, it is inappropriate to comment or refer to rulings issued by the judiciary system or procedures and reports taken by the Justice Departments in other countries, wrote Ayman Walash, the director of Egyptian government's Foreign Press Center. In his email, Walash also emphasized that the Justice Department had closed the investigation without charges. As he campaigns to return to the White House, Trump has cast himself as a victim of deep state plots that sought to undermine his presidency, focusing his ire on the Russia probe that shadowed much of his time in office. Now, that investigation did not ultimately find that Trump or his campaign had conspired with Moscow, but it did conclude his team expected the campaign would benefit from Russian interference. Unbeknownst to the public, during the same period, Justice Department officials were investigating whether Trump had received help from the government of another foreign country, Egypt.
Dom, in the year since Egypt case was closed, the Sisi regime's ambitions to influence senior U.S. government officials have been laid bare by the bribery conviction of Senator Bob Menendez, you know, the Dem from New Jersey, the former chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And over the course,
gold bars and a new Mercedes.
Over the course of his presidency, Trump shifted U.S. policy in ways that benefited the Egyptian leader, a man he once called my favorite dictator.
Wow.
In 2018, Trump's State Department released $195 million in military aid the United States had been withholding over human rights abuses, a move that had been opposed by his first Secretary of State, followed by the release of $1.2 billion more in such assistance. So
oh,
Trump
man,
gave Sissy
payout for $10
million. $1.4 billion he gave him back, Dom, over the objections of his own State Department. The Justice Department and U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. declined to answer detailed questions for this report. The FBI declined to answer the Post questions or to make Christopher Wray available for comment. Bill Barr, shockingly, Dom, also declined to answer detailed questions. In lieu, the special counselor did not respond to a similar inquiry. In an interview, Michael Sherwin, then acting U.S. attorney who closed the case and a veteran prosecutor of complicated national security cases, said he had previously closed some where sufficient evidence never materialized. I made the same decision here. I stand by it, Sherwin said. This is an exclusive account of the Egypt investigation, and it's based on a review of thousands of pages of government records, including sealed court filings and exhibits. The Post also interviewed more than two dozen people with knowledge of the investigation, and the individual spoke on the condition of anonymity. Dumb. I jump forward. The investigation was shrouded in secrecy for the entirety of more than 3 years the case was open, from 17 to 2020. It surfaced obliquely in that time only once when senior judges closed a part of the federal courthouse in D.C. to hide the identities of the parties in a hearing then described as involving a state-owned foreign corporation that was resisting a subpoena. Many observers assumed the corporation was Russia. In the final weeks of the 2020 presidential campaign, after the investigation had been closed, CNN revealed that the mysterious courthouse hearing involved an Egyptian bank. The network also reported that special counsel Robert Mueller had led the case, which centered on an informant's tip that money had flowed through the bank to help fund Trump's campaign. CNN also reported that in the end stages of the probe, some prosecutors proposed subpoenaing Trump's financial records before top officials ultimately concluded that the case had reached a dead end. Yeah, because you stopped looking. You stopped looking.
Move along. Nothing to see here. Everything is fine.
Oh, the cash withdrawal, Dom? $9,998,000, just $2,000 short of $10 million. Come back. More Devil's Advocates. It's Friday. We air the grievances. I got a problem with this story.
The Devil's Advocates. Sausage making never looked so good.
And we are back from the 420 break. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Love it when you would join us on the party line. You can do so now before our friend James Santel, former U.S. attorney, joins us at the bottom of the hour. That number, talk or text, 844-967-2789.
Dom, there's a lot more in this exclusive at the Washington Post, alleging that the investigation of $10 million cash, well, $9,998,000 may have been delivered to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump had met with the president of Egypt, the dictator, his favorite dictator, on September 19th of 2016, according to the reporting. I'm going to read on. Less than 2 months before Election Day, then-candidate Trump had met with Sisi on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. The campaign's account of the closed-door meeting gave no indication that Trump had held the Egyptian leader at arm's length, as U.S. officials typically had done since Sisi had seized power in a military coup 3 years earlier. He doesn't mind that, Dom.
No,
and swept
he likes
aside
that kind of
the country's first democratically elected president. After the meeting, the campaign said Trump had told Sisi that the United States would be a loyal friend to Egypt if he were elected president. And on Fox News, Trump praised him as a fantastic guy. Dom, investigators also viewed it as potentially meaningful that after he assumed office, Trump quickly embraced Sisi, the people said, breaking with U.S. policy under President Barack Obama. Trump invited the Egyptian leader to be one of his first guests at the White House and met with him again, among other Arab leaders, on his first trip abroad. As Mueller's team got going, investigators focused on how at the time the candidate Trump met with Sisi in 2016. Now, Trump's campaign had been running low on funds. They learned through interviews with the candidate's closest advisors that they had pled with Trump to write a check to his campaign in the final blitz of television ads. Trump repeatedly declined. Cheap bastard that he was, right? Until October 28th, roughly 5 weeks after meeting with Sisi, when he announced the $10 million infusion.
I got $10 million.
Dom, in the context of the Egyptian intelligence, investigators considered the amount a point of interest, people familiar with the probe said. Though the infusion was recorded in campaign finance reports as a contribution, Trump's campaign finance chairman had structured the transaction as a loan that could be repaid to Trump to persuade him to approve the deal, according to FBI interview notes of a key Trump advisor. Team 10, this was the investigatory team, Dom, began looking for signs of the alleged transfer at the same amount, searching for evidence of money either leaving Egypt or arriving with Trump. Well, if you got 200 pounds of cash, which equates to just under $10 million, Dom, I mean, what are you checking, FedEx records? I mean, this is being shipped like a brick of money.
Right.
In early 2018, according to previously unreported documents reviewed by the Post, investigators had obtained records from a handful of Trump's most heavily used bank accounts and analyzed large transfers between May and November 2016 from before the Trump-Sisi meeting in New York until after Trump wired money to his campaign. It was a narrower window of time when investigators wanted to scrutinize, according to people familiar with the internal discussions, but Mueller generally insisted on keeping the investigation as narrow as possible and not veering into Trump's finances after he became president. And the bank records offered no evidence that Trump had taken money from Egypt, according to documents reviewed by the Post. In analyzing the records, Dom, investigators focused on two real estate transactions that brought Trump large sums in the fall of 2016. One of those was the refinancing of a Las Vegas property, which the New York Times later pointed to as a possible source of the $10 million infusion to his campaign. Agents concluded both were irrelevant to the Egypt investigation, according to people briefed on the case, and Peter Carr, a Justice Department spokesman, declined to comment on behalf of the former special counsel's office.
Yeah, imagine that. Curdy, in July of 2018, Mueller's team subpoenaed the National Bank of Egypt. The government was searching for transactions of approximately $10 million, according to people familiar with the investigation. The demand sparked a secret court battle that would consume Team 10, now this is Mueller's team, you know, following the Egypt lead, for the remainder of the Mueller report. They got into a subpoena fight. They got into a legal fight. This went up to, I believe, the Supreme Court. And eventually, they did relent. And that's when they bank records contained one especially tantalizing item, a short handwritten letter dated January 15th of 2017, in which an organization called the Research and Study Center asked the bank, quote, kindly withdraw a sum of $9,998,000 from its Heliopolis branch located about 7 miles from the Cairo International Airport. According to bank records, employees assembled the money the same day entirely in U.S. $100 bills, put it in two large bags, and kept it in the bank manager's office until two men associated with the account and two others came and took the cash away. Now, Mueller's team gathered prosecutors and agents to brief them on the newly obtained documents. To people in the room, the withdrawal seemed to bolster the classified intelligence and validate the decision to have had Mueller's team investigate, according to people familiar. It wasn't a smoking gun, one of the people said, describing the thinking at the time, but it was very clear that there was so much smoke and now more smoke. There must be a fire. Now, Mueller, meanwhile, had been moving to close down his operation, having nearly completed his probe of the alleged Russian interference. By early 2019, he had asked other federal prosecutors' offices to take over his team's unfinished investigations. That was taken up by Lou in the U.S. Attorney's Office, ultimately.
$10 million taken out in cash, and Donald Trump gets a $10 million infusion, a loan he gives to the campaign just in the final moments.
Well, if you're going to launder the money, you might as well take ownership of it, man, because that way you can get benefit from it twice.
Well, isn't that a sweet deal? Come back with us. We got a fine former U.S. attorney and friend of ours, James Santel. He joins us. We're going to ask him, what the hell? What the hell indeed? What is going on? And did Bill Barr kill this investigation as he had been accused of doing with others? He certainly misconstrued the findings of the Mueller report. What Bill Barr told we, the American people, was not what Mueller had in his report. We got nothing but pure James Santel coming next. Unadulterated Santelli. More Devil's Advocates. And don't forget, listen to his fine program, Amicus, a law review Saturday mornings right here on Civic Media. More Devil's Advocates with James Santel, our good friend.
When they go low, we get high. The Devil's Advocates.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Made it till Friday. That means get up tomorrow morning. Amicus, a law review, will be on the civic media stations all around the state. And we've got the fine host right now, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours, James Santel. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
Mike Dunn, good to be with you once again to talk about the Department of Justice once again. What the heck is going on? We need to review this, right?
I blame you for all the bad actions of Bill Barr. You knew the guy once, right?
You used to work there, Jim.
I did. How curious is that? And you left, and now all this comes out, right? It sure seems awfully circumstantially indicting, doesn't it? Yeah.
Jim, the reporting, the exclusive at the Washington Post, is that Donald Trump perhaps received $10 million cash from the Egyptians. He clearly made some policy choices that totally contradicted his predecessor. The guy he did the benefit for, the Egyptian president or coup leader, Sisi, effectively had taken that office. As Trump called him, he was my favorite dictator. But Jim, this would be a big, let's call it broken law. Foreign governments cannot finance U.S. campaigns, certainly can't give $10 million. Jim, what did you think of the reporting at the Post?
Right, many things. Let's start with that one right there. Nobody can dispute that, again, if a foreign government is giving a candidate, especially one for federal office monies, federal law undeniably violative of the law. So we start there. And then we go back, as your previous reporting from your previous segments indicates, you've got investigators here, you've got prosecutors. We don't just hear a little tip about something and say, gee, maybe this happened, maybe this didn't. But as I'm listening to your accounting on this fine broadcast station about all of the things the Washington Post has discovered and uncovered as a part of this investigation many years ago, I'm seeing prosecutors and investigators going down a long road. They're examining all these different paths. They're doing what we always call following the money, right? They're doing all these things that you would normally do if you've made the conclusion fairly early on, which you can do, that there is something to explore here. And yes, you can't just pick up something and say, gosh, I don't like Jim Santel. I'm going to go explore some things and see what comes up. Can't do that. But if you've got more than a scintilla, as we sometimes say, of evidence, plainly you had it here. It's not just circumstantial. Yes, there are things about the timing, changes in foreign policy that all suggest that this was inappropriate. But you've got more than that, right? You've got these transactions, you've got documents, you've got financial records. And what all that leads to, of course, is the question, what happened? Why didn't this go forward? And I see two things here. One perhaps benign, one not so benign. One is that Bob Mueller, again, as we know, we've talked about this a lot, I haven't spoken about the Mueller report in many, many appearances here. Let's do it again. One of the faults of that is he didn't follow money, right? He explicitly said, I'm looking at transactions. I'm going to talk about conversations. And I think a lot of people looking back at that said, well, there is more to that Russia thing, as Donald Trump says, than just the transactions. Didn't do that and then pass this off. And then we get to Bill Barr, or maybe this fellow came, named Michael Sherwin, who apparently is the one who finally decided to bring this to an end. At some point, then you look to them and you say, what was your information? What was your exculpatory information after all this? Exculpatory meaning the thing that convinced you that there was no there there, that prompted you to abandon this after all this time. What was that that showed you unequivocally that this investigation was going nowhere and there was not a crime? What was that? And certainly in the wake of this, we don't have an answer to that. But again, our nation turns its lonely eyes to you, Bill Barr, once again, and tell us what happened here. This is fascinating legally, horrific in terms of once again, an investigation dropped, apparently at the hands of an attorney general, or at least his supervisors there, who again had a history of this. We recall this well, you mentioned it just before. The Mueller investigation mischaracterized, Michael Flynn, that, all of those things. This attorney general was not above, not beyond saying, you know what, bring this to an end. Did he do it here again? Awful lot of reason to think we've got belief in that. Yes.
Well, Jim, you said what happened? They hit a brick wall, and the brick wall was they were not able to continue to investigate the different monetary accounts, the transactions that could have funneled into Trump's campaign accounts, personal accounts, whatever the case may be, Jim. Because, of course, this was not a generous man who very last minute decided to throw $10 million into his own campaign. Well, I would wonder, Jim, could they go back and continue this investigation, or is this case closed forevermore?
Right. And so the question is, what kinds of events and activities, what is the timing on these, right? We've got, depending on how you charge this case, we always think about what the statute of limitations, right? We've got 2016, once again, some things in 2017, same kind of time period. So you're coming up on certainly 10 years, right? But you're inside that, depending upon how you charge this. That could still be a possibility. The issue, again, I think, for the American public is, even if you choose as a simply policy matter not to go back and renew this and review this once again, probably a lot of the leads are now stale and old. The financial records are always there, but you always want to get human beings to come forward and describe what is going on, kind of a Michael Cohen, if you will, that guy who brings the cement to all of this. So the question is, once again, historically, what happened here inside the Department of Justice? And was there some involvement of the president himself? Hard to believe, based upon his past activities, that there wasn't some direction. And here's where it gets really caustic once again. If Donald Trump had conversations with Bill Barr about this, they're talking about whether or not to pursue this and basically not to pursue this. What do we know from what the Supreme Court told us on July 1? Absolute immunity for communications with the Department of Justice, and you simply draw a big bright X through all of that, if indeed your focus is on things related to communications between the president, Department of Justice, even beyond that, we need to know. And Bill Barr needs to be asked about this by whether it's a congressional committee or by one of the many appearances he's making now to try to resurrect his image in the American view. This should not go away. This should not be simply a flash in the pan type story on a Friday afternoon.
James Santella, former U.S. Attorney, host of Amicus, a law review on Saturdays here on the Civic Media Network, 9 to 11 a.m. Jim, the Washington Post article concludes that the statute of limitations ran out for illegal campaign contributions on January 15th, 2022. But as mentioned, there could be other statutes that could be found to be, you know, something worth charging. But I wanted to ask you about the CIA. Now, the CIA, apparently, according to this article, was part of the source. So the intelligence had come from a party of a confidential informant who had previously provided useful information. Intelligence the CIA gathered in other operations corroborated part of that individual's account. So they got like multiple sources from a source that has been accurate in the past. Now, when Barr took this over, he told Liu, who was investigating, to personally review the underlying information. The article goes on to say that she actually reviewed the intelligence and went to the CIA headquarters. But they also say that CIA officials had relayed to Liu concerns that apart from Trump's bank records, again, this is on the tail end of the Russian investigation, other steps investigators also wanted to take could, quote, jeopardize their operations, the CIA's operations. So if now how do we verify it and know if that's even accurate? You know what I'm saying? Could that, because if you have control over the government, you just have your spook say, hey, this is what you say, and boom, they shut it down. What's your thought on how the CIA handled this thing, Jim, based on
right.
the report?
So, yeah, once again, this is, especially since if it's really not going anywhere, if we have blown the statute of limitations, then there is some public interest beyond just a future prosecution in knowing what happened here. And so, again, you've got the CIA, many, many thoughts on that as well. You plainly have agents there who are concerned, certainly, again, their jurisdiction is overseas, right? It's not domestic like the FBI is, but theirs is overseas. And they're concerned about places like, and governments like Egypt. Sisi was recently done this coup there. They're concerned about their own agents in the Middle East, right? There are all these kinds of things. So they may have a strong interest in this continuing in some way to pursue it. Just in the interest of national security, that could be a part of this. And then you also ask, again, the Congress has oversight of the CIA, even in a closed door session, what prompted your actions here? Were you in favor of closing this down? What is it that you did in response to any pressure? What kinds of consequences were you thinking about? All of that should be exposed in some way to try to get to the bottom of exactly what was motivating the CIA in this. Were they getting pressure from the president, from even the attorney general, others there? Lots and lots of questions here. None of it leading to good answers, by the way, which again underscores the reason why Americans need to look at this story and say, once again, a corrupt administration, at least more than, maybe not beyond a reasonable doubt yet, but you've got more than just a scintilla. You've got some probable cause to believe that something very illegal happened here.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. We got a fine guest. He is former U.S. attorney, friend of ours. He's got answers, James Santel. Jim, $1.4 billion in military aid was extended by Trump. First, $195 million, and then $1.2 billion over the objections, according to the Washington Post, of his own Secretary of State. His own Secretary of State, his own State Department didn't want this money released. Jim, if in fact he took $10 million from the Egyptians and he turned around, let's call it a quid pro quo, and gave $1.4 billion back, is this a greater crime? Would this charge differently, if you were still a prosecutor, sir?
Sure. You begin to look at, again, conspiracy charges. The substantive transfers of money can be problematic. They can be in violation of law. Again, I would look to conspiracies or who was involved in doing this. And the other piece of this, depending on how you charge this down the road, is using that evidence. Does that sort of thing come in a trial before a jury? Of course it does, because it provides what? It provides a motive. It provides purpose. It provides direction. You basically took money for the purpose of getting elected. The arrangement, the quid pro quo, as Amy Coney Barrett recently said in that Trump case, she said, you know, if you find out about the quid, the jury needs to know about the quo too. That's exactly what we've got going on here. Would that be relevant? Would that come in a trial? And it's not circumstantial evidence. That's direct evidence, once again, of your motive for doing this. And if you can get people, whether it's from the State Department or documents simply confirming that this was not a part of the approved policy, and he did this over the objection of people who are our diplomats, who know what they're talking about, but felt obliged to do this anyway because this was the payback, this was the quid pro quo, does that make the intent even more compelling in a criminal trial? You bet it would. And frankly, that might even be core to your opening statement and closing argument. Everything else in between establishes all of that. And so once again, that's the reason why this particular transaction, there'll be more reporting on this, obviously, as this plays out. Very, very significant to understand what happened here. Let's pursue this more.
Couldn't he just turn around and claim what the U.S. Supreme Court has given him, get out of jail free card effectively? Well, these were official acts. I made a decision. I'm the president. It's my decision whether or not to fund this military aid to Egypt over the objections of the U.S. State Department. But if he did it, isn't he basically above scrutiny of motive, Jim, if I understood the Supreme Court's ruling on the presidential immunity case?
Absolutely. John Roberts tells the world you can't inquire Jack Smith into purpose. What? What? So again, you look at the Chief Justice and you say, if indeed that's we were serious about all of this, it really does shut this down dramatically, not just with respect to the Department of Justice, but all these other things. He simply says, listen, I'm the commander in chief. Official acts, those the Supreme Court has said, you stay away from those, presumption that I'm immune from those, and I am good to go. And I think it's a compelling argument to make. Frankly, if I were a federal district court judge, which I'm not, you might look at this and say, this is what the Supreme Court standard is. Under these circumstances, Mr. Prosecutor, Ms. Prosecutor, I don't have any choice but to dismiss this. This is why this immunity decision is so, so horrific, has these tendrils all over the place, including potentially in this matter as well.
Well, James Santel, our fine guest, maybe should get your opinion about Joe Biden's proposition for reforming the U.S. Supreme Court. And also, I understand it's game on time in Chutkan's courtroom. The January 6th back for many trials, perhaps. I got many questions. And a fine guest will provide answers. He's James Santel. We're the Devils. Stick around.
Of the time, they're right every time. The Devil's Advocates.
Back to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Happy Friday to us all. Phone lines always open for your take. 844-967-2789.
Dom, we got a fine guest. I'm not sure if he's a love machine, but rumor has it he's James Santel, host of Amicus, a law review Saturday mornings right here on the Civic Media Network. Jim, we appreciate you giving us a little preview and answering our questions. U.S. Supreme Court. Joe Biden has put forth a proposition, sir, to reform this court. Jim, do you have any optimism? And what would it really take to reform the court? Like a governing majority? What do we need? We just need to set aside the filibuster once, don't we?
We do. We need governing authorities, obviously, in both houses of the Congress. He's got this package that talks about three different things. He's proposing some of them to legislatively, that is the action of the House and the Senate. And he's also proposing a constitutional amendment that basically says no immunity for presidents. That's a very big lift. You've got to get both houses of Congress. You've got to get three quarters of the states to buy into all that. So the answer to your first part of your question is, these are no small things to undertake. Can they be done? Sure they can. We've done them in our history many, many times, and we can get them done legislatively if you've got the political will to do it. Interestingly, again, he is sort of parsed out where he would like to go with this. At the same time, you've got Chuck Schumer in the Senate, who's taking that no immunity concept, which Biden thinks should be in the Constitution. I think that's right too, but if he can't get that, Chuck Schumer says, let's do this legislatively. What does he introduce? He introduces the No Kings Act, in the United States Senate, and he would accomplish that legislatively. Again, you need the House, you need the Senate, you need a president to sign off on that. But basically, again, establishing legislatively that you do not have immunity, you can't commit crimes as a president. And then you've got these other pieces, which include term limits, fascinating notion. Again, according to Sheldon Whitehouse, who's a senator from Rhode Island, and Dick Durbin from Illinois, just to the south of us here, both of them saying 18-month terms. They've introduced legislation already to suggest
18-year terms. Sorry, Jim.
I'm sorry, 18-year terms, exactly, right? 18-year terms. Again, they're proposing a legislative fix on that. Typically, we think about lifetime tenure. I think it's got some interesting aspects to it. There you've got that as well. And then the
but
third
nothing
one is
changes the math, Jim, right? And that's the problem. The problem is it's a stacked court. You got 6-3, and the six are willing to overturn precedent, whatever they need to do. They seem very convinced that they have all the power because they got the six votes, Jim.
Right, exactly. And so that's where we are today. Part of this proposal into the weeds is that what Joe and some of these congressional folks are proposing is what you do is you kind of create an emeritus status. You're basically Clarence Thomas and you look at Sam Alito and say, gosh, you've been around a long period of time. We're going to keep you as Supreme Court justices. We're going to put you in some other responsible positions. We'll bring you back for only those original jurisdiction cases. Everything else, your seats deciding those cases are now empty. We'll appoint new people. That's what the proposal is. And that's why it sort of gets around the constitutional issue. And then you've got the other issue, as you're both hinting at, which is the ethics point. And there, once again, there's legislation being introduced. It has been introduced to try to establish a code of ethics that is enforceable. Fascinating to see that Elena Kagan's out in California just the past week or so saying, yeah, good idea, and needs to be enforced by whom? By a set of federal district court judges, maybe trial court judges, appellate court judges, appointed by the Chief Justice, and they will tell us when we should be recused and when we shouldn't be handling. She says that out loud today. What, is it going to go anywhere? Probably not, but the fact of the matter is he's raising the issue, the president is, these others are animating for it, and America should take notice of it. Absolutely.
James Santel, just three more minutes. The U.S. Supreme Court has handed the case back to Chutkan on Trump's, what, election interference, riotous case. Now she's going to, what, have to determine what was an official act, what was not an official act. But this gives us perhaps an opportunity, what people are referring to as these mini trials. Can we see this starting perhaps as early as Monday, Jim? I mean, Monday's
Monday. Unlikely, right? They'd probably press the electronic button to send the package of stuff from the Supreme Court over to Chutkan's chambers. She was not happy to get that, I'm sure, because this really is a dumpster fire. And they basically said, here, now you figure out what it is we just said. The most beleaguered judge in America today is Chutkan. So yeah, she's got this. My guess is what she's going to do is she's going to say, counsel on both sides, tell me what you think is left of this case. Tell me what you think we should do. Maybe file some memorandums and then have a hearing about what the next steps are. A lot of things you got to parse through. It's not just the official and unofficial. This weird bifurcation the Supreme Court did. You got to figure out again what stuff is absolutely immune, what the justice stuff is. That gets thrown away almost immediately. Not a lot of argument on that. Then you've got these presumptions along the way. You've got all sorts of evidentiary things. Amy Coney Barrett takes exception to some of that. All this stuff, kind of crazy things about even pretrial motions and, again, evidentiary things that she's got to find or not find. It's a lot. It's what any judge does. But there are also weird interpretations of the evidence rules that that Chutkan does not embrace. She's got a lot of work in front of her, not just on legal issues, but also could have these hearings arguably with some substantive evidence about what the case is really about, kind of pre-trying the case to figure out what, in fact, she can admit during the course of the trial. Could be going on in the fall. She can schedule at least for the fall yet. A full-blown trial, unlikely, unlikely.
But I want it now, Danny. James Intel, thank you so much for joining us. What are you talking about on Amicus, the law review tomorrow, Jim?
So we're talking about some lower federal court judges, not these, also doing some curious things out there with everything from from the NFL to transgender rights to all sorts of access by people of low income capacities to electronic communications. Lots of interesting things at lower court levels that are challenging and difficult to hear as well. So we're going to talk about those among the regular stuff.
Learn stuff with Amicus, a law review, and our friend James Santel. Tune in Saturday mornings, 9 to 11. Jim, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, fella.
Thank you, Jim.
Happy Friday. Take care. Thanks so much.